Chapter 2. About the middle of September, the Indians became very troublesome on the line of the stage along the Sweetwater, between Split Rock and Three Crossings. A stage had been robbed and two passengers killed outright. Lem Flowers, the driver, was badly wounded. The thievish Redskins also drove stock repeatedly from the stations. They were continually lying in wait for passing stages and Pony Express riders. It was useless to keep the express going until these depredations could be stopped. A layoff of 6 weeks was ordered, and our time was our own. While we were thus idle, a party was organized to carry the war into the Indians' own country, and teach them that the white man's property must be let alone. This party I joined. Stage drivers, express riders, stock tenders and ranchmen, 40 in number, composed this party. All were well armed, all were good shots, and brave, determined men. While Bill Hickok, another of the Western gunmen of whom I shall have something to tell later, was captain of the expedition. He had come recently to our division, as a stage driver, and had the experience and courage necessary to that kind of leadership. 20 miles out from Sweetwater Bridge, at the head of Horse Creek, we found an Indian trail running north toward Powder River. We could see that the horses had been recently shod, conclusive proof that they were our stolen stock. We pushed on, as fast as we could along the trail to the Powder, thence down this stream to within 40 miles of where old Fort Reno now stands. Farther on, at Crazy Woman's Fork, we saw evidence that another party had joined our quarry. The trail was newly made. The Indians could be hardly more than 24 hours ahead of us. And plainly there was a lot of them. When we reached Clear Creek, another tributary of the Powder, we saw horses grazing on the opposite bank. Horses meant Indians. Never before had the Redskins been followed so far into their own country. Not dreaming that they would be pursued, they had failed to put out scouts. We quickly got the lay of their camp, and held a council to decide on how to attack them. We knew that they outnumbered us 3-1, perhaps more. Without strategy, all we would get for our long chase would be the loss of our scalps. While Bill, who did not know the meaning of fear, made our plan for us. We were to wait till nightfall, and then, after creeping up as close as possible on the camp, make a grand ride right through it, open a general fire upon them, and stampede their horses. It was a plan that called for nerve, but we were full of spirit, and the more danger there was in an enterprise, the more we relished it. At our captain's signal, we rushed pell-mell through their camp. Had we dropped from the clouds, the Indians could not have been more astonished. At the sound of our shots, they scattered in every direction, yelling warnings to each other as they fled. Once clear of the camp, we circled to the south and came back to make sure that we had done a thorough job. A few parting shots stampeded the stragglers. Then, with 100 captured ponies, most, if not all of them, stolen from the express and state stations, we rode back to Sweetwater Bridge. The recovered horses were placed on the road again, and the express was resumed. Slade, who was greatly pleased with our exploit, now assigned me as special or supernumerary rider. Thereafter, while I was with him, I had a comparatively easy time of it, riding only now and then, and having plenty of opportunity for seeking after the new adventures in which I delighted. Al Slade, stage line superintendent, frontiersman, and daredevil fighting man, was one of the far-famed gunmen of the plains. These were a race of men bred by the perils and hard conditions of Western life. They became man-killers first from stern necessity. In the day, the man who was not quick on the trigger had little chance with the outlaws among whom he had to live. Slade and Wild Bill, with both of whom I became closely associated, were men of nerve and courage. But both, having earned the reputation of gunfighters, became too eager to live up to it. Eventually both became outlaws. Slade, though always a dangerous man, and extremely rough in his manner, never failed to treat me with kindness. Sober, he was cool and self-possessed, but never a man to be trifled with. Drunk, he was a living fury. His services to the company, for which he worked, were of high value. He was easily the best superintendent on the line. but his habit of man-killing at last resulted in his execution. Another man who gained even greater notoriety than Slade was Wild Bill Hickok, a tall, yellow-haired giant, who had done splendid service as a scout in the western sector of the Civil War. Wild Bill I had known since 1857. He and I shared the pleasure of walking 1,000 miles to the Missouri River, after the bull train in which we both were employed had been burned by Lot Smith, the Mormon raider. Afterward we rode the Pony Express together. While an express rider, Bill had the fight with the McCandless gang, which will always form an interesting chapter in the history of the West. Coming into a swing station at Rock Creek one day, Bill failed to arouse anyone with the shouts for a fresh mount. This was a certain indication of trouble. It was the stock tender's business to be on hand with a really pony the instant the rider came in. The Pony Express did not tolerate delays. Galloping into the yard, Bill dismounted and hurried to the stable. In the door he saw the stock tender lying dead, and at the same instant a woman's screams rang from the cabin nearby. Turning about, Bill found himself face to face with a ruffian who was rushing from the house, brandishing a six-shooter. He asked no questions, but pulled one of the two guns he carried and fired. No sooner had the man fallen, however, than a second, also armed, came out of the house. Hickok disposed of this fellow also, and then entered the place, where four others opened the fusillade on him. Although the room was thick with smoke, and Bill had to use extreme care to avoid hitting the woman, who was screaming in the corner, he managed to kill two of his assailants with his revolvers, and to ward off a blow with a rifle a third had leveled at him. The blow knocked the weapon from his hand, but his knife was still left him, and with it he put the man with the rifle out of the way. His troubles were not at an end, however. Another man came climbing in the window, to avenge his fellow gangsters. Bill reached for a rifle, which lay on the floor and shot first. When he took out a few minutes later he discovered that he had killed 5 men and wounded a sixth, who escaped in the thick of the fight. The woman, who had been knocked unconscious by one of the desperados, was soon revived. She was the stock tender's wife, and had been attacked by gang as soon as they had slain her husband. The passengers of the overland stage, which rolled in as Bill was reviving the terrified woman, were given a view of Western life, which none of them ever forgot. Bill was the hero of the occasion, and a real hero he was, for probably never has a man won such a victory against such terrific odds in all the history of the war against the refiners of the West. It was at Springfield, Missouri, that Bill had his celebrated fight with Dave Tutt. The fight put an end to Tutt's career. I was a personal witness to another of his gun exploits, in which, though the chances were all against him, he protected his own life and incidentally his money. An inveterate poker player, he got into a game in Springfield with big players and for high stakes. Sitting by the table, I noticed that he seemed sleepy and inattentive. So I kept a close watch on the other fellows. Presently I observed that one of his opponents was occasionally dropping a card in his hat, which he held in his lap, until a number of cards had been laid away for future use in the game. The pot had gone around several times, and was steadily raised by some of the players, Bill staying right along, though he still seemed to be drowsy. The bets kept rising. At last the man with the hat full of cards picked a hand out of his reserves, put the hat on his head and raised Bill $200. Bill came back with a raise of 200, and as the other covered it he quietly shoved the pistol into his face and observed, "I am calling the hand that is in your hat." Illustration: he shoved the pistol in the man's face, and said, "I'm calling the hand that's in your hat." Gathering in the pot with his left hand, he held the pistol with his right and inquired if any of the players had any objections to offer. They hastened to reply that they had no objections whatever, and we went away from there. "Bill," I said, when we were well outside the place, "I had been noticing that fellows play right along, but I thought you hadn't. I was going to get into the game myself, if he beat you out of that money." "Billy," replied Hickok, "I don't want you ever to learn it, but that is one of my favorite poker tricks. It always wins against crooked players. Not all of the gunmen of the West begin straight. Some of them, many, in fact, were thieves and murderers from the beginning." Such were the members of the McCandless gang, which Hickok disposed of so thoroughly. All along the stage route were robbers and man-killers far more vicious than the Indians. Very early in my career as a frontiersman I had an encounter with a party of these, from which I was extremely fortunate to escape with my life. I employed the leisure afforded me by my assignment, as an extra rider in hunting excursions, in which I took a keen delight. I was returning home empty-handed from a bear hunt, when night overtook me in a lonely spot near a mountain stream. I had killed two sage hens and built a little fire, over which to broil them before my night's rest. Suddenly I heard a horse whinny farther up the stream. Thinking instantly of Indians, I ran quickly to my own horse, to prevent him from answering the call, and thus revealing my presence. Filled with uneasiness, as to who and what my human neighbors might be, I resaddled my horse, and, leaving him tied where I could reach him in a hurry if need be, made my way upstream to reconnoiter. As I came around a bend I received an unpleasant shock. Not one horse, but 15 horses, were grazing just ahead of me. On the opposite side of the creek a light shone high up the mountain bank, a light from the window of a dugout. I drew near very cautiously till I came within sound of voices within the place, and discovered that its occupants were conversing in my own language. That relieved me. I knew the strangers to be white men. I supposed them to be trappers, and, walking boldly to the door, I knocked. Instantly the voices ceased. There ensued absolute silence for a space, and then came whisperings, and sounds of men quietly moving about the dirt floor. "Who's there?" called someone. "A friend and a white man," I replied. The door opened, and a big, ugly-looking fellow stood before me. "Come in," he ordered. I accepted the invitation with hesitation, but there was nothing else to do. To retreat would have meant pursuit and probably death. 8 of the most villainous-appearing ruffians I have ever set eyes upon sat about the dugout as I entered. 2 of them I recognized at once as teamsters, who had been employed by Simpson a few months before. Both had been charged with murdering a ranchman and stealing his horses. Simpson had promptly discharged them, and it was supposed that they had left the country. I gave them no sign of recognition. I was laying my plans to get out of there as speedily as possible. I was now practically certain that I had uncovered the hiding place of a gang of horse thieves, who could have no possible reason to feel anything but hostility toward an honest man. The leader of the gang swaggered toward me and inquired menacingly, "Where are you going, young man, and who's with you?" "I'm entirely alone," I returned. "I left Horseshoe Station this morning for a bear hunt. Not finding any bears, I was going to camp out till morning. I heard one of your horses whinnying, and came up to your camp." "Where is your horse?" "I left him down the creek." They proposed going for the horse, which was my only means of getting rid of their unwelcome society. I tried strategy to forestall them. "I'll go and get him," I said. "I'll leave my gun here." This, I fancied, would convince them that I intended to return, but it didn't. "Jim and I will go with you," said one of the thieves. "You can leave your gun here if you want to. You won't need it." I saw that if I was to get away at all I would have to be extremely alert. These were old hands, and were not to be easily fooled. I felt it safer, however, to trust myself with 2 men than with 6, so I volunteered to show the precious pair where I had left the horse, and led them to my camp. The animal was secured, and as one of the men started to lead him up the stream I picked up the 2 sage hens I had intended for my evening meal. The more closely we approached the dugout the less I liked the prospect of re-entering it. One plan of escape had failed. I was sure the ruffians had no intention of permitting me to leave them, and inform the stage people of their presence in the country. One more plan suggested itself to me, and I lost no time in trying it. Dropping one of the sage hens, I asked the man behind me to pick it up. As he was groping for it in the darkness, I pulled one of my Colt's revolvers, and hit him a terrific blow over the head. He dropped to the ground, senseless. Wheeling about, I saw that the other man, hearing the fall, had turned his hand upon his revolver. It was no time for argument. I fired and killed him. Then, leaping on my horse, I dug the spurs into his sides, and back down the trail we went, over the rocks and rough ground toward safety. Illustration: it was no time for argument. I fired, and killed him. My peril was far from past. At the sound of the shot, the six men in the dugout tumbled forth in hot haste. They stopped an instant at the scene of the shooting, possibly to revive the man I had stunned, and to learn from whom what had happened. They were too wise to mount their horses, knowing that, afoot, they could make better time over the rocky country than I could on horseback. Steadily I heard them gaining, and soon made up my mind that if I was to evade them at all, I must abandon my horse. Jumping off, I gave him a smart slap with the butt of my revolver, which sent him down the valley. I turned and began to scramble up the mountainside. I had climbed hardly 40 feet when I heard them pass, following the sound of my horse's feet. I dodged behind the tree as they went by, and when I heard them firing farther down the trail, I worked my way up the mountainside. It was 25 miles to Horseshoe Station, and very hard traveling the first part of the way. But I got to the station, just before daylight, weary and footsore, but exceedingly thankful. Tired as I was, I woke up the men at the station and told them of my adventure. Slade himself led the party that set out to capture my former hosts, and I went along, though nearly beat out. 20 of us, after a brisk ride, reached the dugout at 10 o'clock in the morning. But the thieves had gone. We found a newly made grave, where they had buried the man I had to kill, and a trail leading southwest toward Denver. It was all. But my adventure at least resulted in clearing the country of horse thieves. Once the gang had gone, no more depredations occurred for a long time. After a year's absence from home, I began to long to see my mother and sisters again. In June, 1861, I got a pass over the stage line, and returned to Leavenworth. The first rumblings of the great struggle that was soon to be known as the Civil War were already reverberating throughout the North. Sumter had been fired upon in April of that year. Kansas, as every schoolboy knows, was previously the bloody scene of some of the earliest conflicts. My mother's sympathies were strongly with the Union. She knew that war was bound to come, but so confident was she in the strength of the federal government that she devoutly believed that the struggle could not last longer than 6 months at the utmost. Fort Leavenworth and the town of Leavenworth were still important outfitting posts for the soldiers in the West and Southwest. The fort was strongly garrisoned by regular troops. Volunteers were undergoing training. Many of my boyhood friends were enlisting. I was eager to join them. But I was still the breadwinner of the family, the sole support of my sisters and my invalid mother. Not because of this, but because of her love for me, my mother exacted from me a promise that I would not enlist for the war while she lived. But during the summer of 1861, a purely local company, known as the Red-Legged Scouts, and commanded by Captain Bill Tuff, was organized. This I felt I could join without breaking my promise not to enlist for the war, and join it I did. The Red-Legged Scouts, while they cooperated with the regular army along the borders of Missouri, had for their specific duty the protection of Kansas against raiders like Quantrell, and such bandits as the James Boys, the Younger Brothers, and other desperados, who conducted a guerrilla warfare against Union settlers. We had plenty to do. The guerrillas were daring fellows and kept us busy. They robbed banks, raided villages, burned buildings, and looted and plundered wherever there was loot or plunder to be had. But Tuff was the same kind of a fighting man as they, and working in a better cause. With his scouts he put the fear of the law into the hearts of the guerrillas, and they notably decreased their depredations in consequence. Whenever and wherever we found that the scattered bands were getting together for a general raid, we would at once notify the regulars at Fort Scott or Fort Leavenworth, to be ready for them. Quantrell once managed to collect 1,000 men in a hurry, and to raid and sack Lawrence, before the troops could head them off. But when we got on their trail, they were driven speedily back into Missouri. In the meantime, we took care that little mischief was done by the gangs headed by the James Boys and the Youngers, who operated in Quantrell's wake and in small bands. In the spring of 63, I left the Red-Legged Scouts to serve the federal government, as guide and scout with the 9th Kansas Cavalry. The Kiowas and Comanches were giving trouble along the old Santa Fe Trail and among the settlements of western Kansas. The 9th Kansas were sent to tame them, and to protect immigrants and settlers. This was work that I well understood. We had a lively summer, for the Indians kept things stirring, but after a summer of hard fighting we made them understand that the great white chief was a power, that the Indians had better not irritate. November, 63, I returned with a command to Leavenworth. I had money in my pockets, for my pay had been $150 a month, and I was able to lay in an abundant supply of provisions for my family. On the 23rd day of December my mother passed away. Her life had been an extremely hard one, but she had borne up bravely under poverty and privation, supplying with her own teaching the education that the frontier schools could not give her children, and by her Christian example setting them all on a straight road through life. Border ruffians killed her husband, almost within sight of her home. She passed months in terror and distress and, until I became old enough to provide for her, often suffered from direst poverty. Yet she never complained for herself, her only thoughts being for her children and the sufferings that were visited upon them because of their necessary upbringing in a rough and wild country. My sister Julia was now married to Al Goodman, a fine and capable young man, and I was free to follow the promptings of an adventurous nature and go where my companions were fighting. In January, 1864, the 7th Kansas Volunteers came to Leavenworth from the south, where they had been fighting since the early years of the war. Among them I found many of my old friends and schoolmates. I was no longer under promise not to take part in the war and I enlisted as a private. In March of that year the regiment was embarked on steamboats and sent to Memphis, Tennessee, where we joined the command of General A.J. Smith. General Smith was organizing an army to fight the illiterate but brilliant Confederate General Forrest, who was then making a great deal of trouble in southern Tennessee. While we were mobilizing near Memphis, Colonel Herrick of our regiment recommended me to General Smith for membership in a picked corps, to be used for duty as scouts, messengers, and dispatch carriers. Colonel Herrick recounted my history as a plainsman, which convinced the commander that I would be useful in this special line of duty. When I reported to General Smith, he invited me into his tent and inquired minutely into my life as a scout. "You ought to be able to render me valuable service," he said. When I replied that I should be only too glad to do so, he got out a map of Tennessee, and on it showed me where he believed General Forrest's command to be located. His best information was that the Confederate commander was then in the neighborhood of Okolona, Mississippi, about 200 miles south of Memphis. He instructed me to disguise myself as a Tennessee boy, to provide myself with a farm horse from the stock in the camp, and to try to locate Forrest's main command. Having accomplished this, I was to gather all the information possible concerning the enemy's strength in men and equipment and defenses, and to make my way back as speedily as possible. General Smith expected to start south the following morning, and he showed me on the map the wagon road he planned to follow, so that I might know where to find him on my return. He told me before we parted that the mission on which he was sending me was exceedingly dangerous. "If you are captured," he said, "you will be shot as a spy." To this I replied that my Indian scouting trips had been equally dangerous, as capture meant torture and death, yet I had always willingly undertaken them. "Do you think you can find Forrest's army?" he said. "Well, if you can't find an army as big as that, you're a mighty poor scout," he said grimly. General Smith then turned me over to the man, who was in charge of what was called the refuge herd, from which I found a mount built on the lines of the average Tennessee farm horse. This man also provided me with a suit of farmer's clothing, for which I exchanged my new soldier uniform, and a bag of provisions. Leading me about a mile from camp, he left me with a warning, "Look out, young fellow. You're taking a dangerous trip." Then we shook hands and I began my journey. I had studied carefully the map General Smith had shown me, and had a fairly accurate idea of the direction I was supposed to take. Following a wagon road that led to the south, I made nearly 60 miles the first night. The mare I had chosen proved a good traveler. When morning came, I saw a big plantation, with the owners and Negroes' houses, just ahead of me. I was anxious to learn how my disguise was going to work, and therefore rode boldly up to the house of the overseer and asked if I could get rest and some sort of breakfast. In response to his inquiries, I said I was a Tennessean and on my way to Holly Springs. I used my best imitation of the Southern dialect, which I can still use on occasion, and it was perfectly successful. I was given breakfast, my mare was fed, and I slept most of the day in a haystack, taking up my journey again immediately after dinner. Thereafter I had confidence in my disguise, and, while making no effort to fall into conversation with people, I did not put myself out to evade anyone whom I met. None of those with whom I talked suspected me of being a northern spy. At the end of a few days I saw that I was near a large body of troops. It was in the morning after a hard day and night ride. Fearing to approach the outpost looking weary and fagged out, I rested for an hour, and then rode up and accosted one of them. To his challenge I said I was a country boy, and had come in to see the soldiers. My father and brother, I said, were fighting with Forrest, and I was almost persuaded to enlist myself. My story satisfied the guard and I was passed. A little farther on I obtained permission to pasture my horse with a herd of animals belonging to the Confederates and, afoot, I proceeded to the camp of the soldiers. By acting the part of the rural Tennessean, making little purchases from the Negro food stands, and staring open-mouthed at all the camp life, I picked up a great deal of information without once falling under suspicion. The question now uppermost in my mind was, how I was going to get away. Toward evening I returned to the pasture, saddled my mare and rode to the pickup line where I had entered. Here, to my dismay, I discovered that the outpost had been recently changed. But I used the same story that had gained admission for me. In a sack tied to my saddle were the food supplies I had bought from the Negroes during the day. These, I explained to the outposts, were intended as presents for my mother and sisters back on the farm. They examined the sack, and, finding nothing contraband in it, allowed me to pass. I now made all possible speed northward, keeping out of sight of houses and of strangers. On the second day I passed several detachments of Forrest's troops, but my training as a scout enabled me to keep them from seeing me. Though my mare had proven herself an animal of splendid endurance, I had to stop and rest her occasionally. At such times I kept closely hidden. It was on the second morning after leaving Forrest's command that I sighted the advance guard of Smith's army. They halted me when I rode up, and for a time I had more trouble with them than I had had with any of Forrest's men. I was not alarmed, however, and when the captain told me that he would have to send me to the rear, I surprised him by asking to see General Smith. "Are you anxious to see a big, fighting general?" he asked in amazement. "Yes," I said. "I hear that General Smith can whip Forrest, and I would like to see any man who can do that." Without any promises I was sent to the rear, and presently I noticed General Smith, who, however, failed to recognize me. I managed, however, to draw near to him and ask him if I might speak to him for a moment. Believing me to be a Confederate prisoner, he assented, and when I had saluted I said, "General, I am Billy Cody, the man you sent out to the Confederate lines." "Report back to your charge," said the general to the officer who had me in custody. "I will take care of this man." My commander was much pleased with my report, which proved to be extremely accurate and valuable. The disguise he had failed to penetrate did not deceive my comrades of the 9th Kansas, and when I passed them they all called me by name, and asked me where I had been. But my news was from my superior officers, and I did not need the warning Colonel Herrick gave me, to keep my mouth shut while among the soldiers. General Smith, too, whom I later made a full detailed report, had spoken highly of my work to Colonel Herrick, who was gratified to know that his choice of a scout had been justified by results. It was not long before the whole command knew of my return, but beyond the fact that I had been on a scouting expedition, and had brought back information much desired by the commander, they knew nothing of my journey. The next morning, still riding the same air and still wearing my Tennessee clothes, I rode out with the entire command in the direction of Forrest's army. Before I had traveled 5 miles, I had been pointed out to the entire command, and cheers greeted me on every side. As soon as an opportunity offered, I got word with the general and asked if he had any further special orders for me. "Just keep around," he said, "I may need you later on." "But I am a scout," I told him, "and the place for a scout is ahead of the army, getting information." "Go ahead," he replied, "and if you see anything that I ought to know about, come back and tell me." Delighted to be a scout once more, I made my way forward. The general had given orders that I was to be allowed to pass in and out the lines at will, so that I was no longer hampered by the activities of my own friends. I had hardly got beyond the sound of the troops when I saw a beautiful plantation house, on the porch of which was a handsome old lady and her two attractive daughters. They were greatly alarmed when I came up, and asked if I didn't know that the Yankee army would be along in a few minutes, and that my life was in peril. All their own men folks, they said, were in hiding in the timber. "Don't you sit here," begged the old lady, when I had seated myself on the porch, to sip a glass of milk for which I had asked her. "The Yankee troops will go right through this house. They will break up the piano and every stick of furniture, and leave the place in ruins. You are sure to be killed or taken prisoner." By this time the advance guard was coming up the road. General Smith passed as I was standing on the porch. I saw that he had noticed me, though he gave no sign of having done so. As more troops passed, men began leaving their companies and rushing toward the house. I walked out and ordered them away in the name of the general. They all knew who I was, and obeyed, much to the astonishment of the old lady and her daughter. Turning to my hostess, I said, "Madam, I can't keep them out of your chicken house or your smoke house or your storerooms, but I can keep them out of your home, and I will." I remained on the porch till the entire command had passed. Nothing was molested. Much pleased, but still puzzled, the old lady was now convinced that I was no Tennessee lad, but a sure enough Yankee, and one with a remarkable amount of influence. When I asked for a little something to eat in return for what I had done, the best there was in the house was spread before me. My hostess urged me to eat as speedily as possible, and be on my way. Her men folks, she said, would soon return from the timber, and if they learned that I was a Yank would shoot me on the spot. As she was speaking, the back door was pushed open and 3 men rushed in. The old lady leapt between them and me. "Don't shoot him," she cried. "He has protected our property and our lives." But the men had no murderous intentions. "Give him all he wants to eat," said the eldest, "and we will see that he gets back to the Yankee lines in safety." We saw him from the treetops turn away the Yanks, as he stood on the porch. While I finished my meal, they put all manner of questions to me, being specially impressed that a boy so young could have kept a great army from foraging so richly stocked a plantation. I told them that I was a Union scout, and that I had saved their property on my own responsibility. "I knew you would be back here," I said. "But I was sure you wouldn't shoot me when you learned what I had done." "You bet your life we won't," they said heartily. After dinner I was stocked tip with all the provisions I wanted, and given a fine bottle of peach brandy, the product of the plantation. Then the men of the place escorted me to the rear guard of the command, which I lost no time in joining. When I overtook the general and presented him with the peach brandy, he said gruffly, "I hear you kept all the men from foraging on that plantation back yonder." "Yes, sir," I said. "An old lady and her two daughters were alone there. My mother had suffered from raids of hostile soldiers in Kansas. I tried to protect that old lady, as I would have liked another man to protect my mother in her distress. I'm sorry if I have disobeyed your orders, and I am ready for any punishment you wish to inflict on me." "My boy," said the general, "you may be too good-hearted for a soldier, but you have done just what I would have done. My orders were to destroy all Southern property. But we will forget your violation of them." General Smith kept straight on toward Forrest's stronghold. 10 miles from the spot where the enemy was encamped, he wheeled to the left and headed for Tupido, Mississippi, reaching there at dark. Forrest speedily discovered that Smith did not intend to attack him on his own ground. So he broke camp, and, coming up to the rear, continued a hot fire through the next afternoon. Arriving near Tupido, General Smith selected, as a battleground, the crest of a ridge commanding the position Forrest had taken up. Between the two armies lay a plantation of 4,000 or 5,000 acres. The next morning Forrest dismounted some 4,000 cavalry, and with cavalry and artillery on his left and right advanced upon our position. Straight across the plantation they came, while Smith rode back and forth behind the long breastworks that protected his men, cautioning them to reserve their fire till it could be made to tell. All our men were fighting with single shotguns. The first shot, in a close action, had to count, or a second one might never be fired. I had been detailed to follow Smith, as he rode to and fro. With an eye to coming out of the battle with a whole skin, I had picked out a number of trees, behind which I proposed to drop my horse, when the fighting got to close quarters. This was the fashion I had always employed in Indian fighting. As the Confederates got within good range, the order "fire" rang out. At that instant I wheeled my horse behind a big oak tree. Unhappily for me, the general was looking directly at me as this maneuver was executed. When we had driven back and defeated Forrest's men, I was ordered to report at General Smith's tent. "Young man," said the general, when I stood before him, "you were recommended to me as an Indian fighter. What were you doing behind that tree?" "That is the way we have to fight Indians, sir," I said. "We get behind anything that offers protection." It was 12 years later that I convinced General Smith that my theory of Indian fighting was pretty correct. After the consolidation of the regular army, following the war, Smith was sent to the plains as Colonel of the 7th Cavalry. This was afterward known as Custer's Regiment, and we engaged in the Battle of the Little Big Horn, in which that gallant commander was slain. Smith's cavalry command was moving southward on an expedition against the Kiowas and Comanches in the Canadian River country, when I joined it as a scout. Dick Curtis, acting as guide for Smith, had been sent on ahead across the river, while the main command stopped to water their horses. Curtis's orders were to proceed straight ahead for 5 miles, where the troops would camp. He was followed immediately by the advance guard, Smith and his staff following on. We had proceeded about 3 miles when 300 or 400 Indians attacked us, jumping out of gullies and ravines, where they had been securely hidden. General Smith at once ordered the orderlies to sound the recall and retreat, intending to fall back quickly on the main command. He was standing close beside a deep ravine as he gave the order. Knowing that the plan he proposed meant the complete annihilation of our force, I pushed my horse close to him. "General," I said, "order your men into the ravine, dismount, and let number 4s hold horses. Then you will be able to stand off the Indians. If you try to retreat to the main command, you and every man under you will be killed before you have retreated a mile." He immediately saw the sense of my advice. Issuing orders to enter the ravine, he dismounted with his men behind the bank. There we stood off the Indians till the soldiers in the rear, hearing the shots, came charging to the rescue and drove the Indians away. The rapidity with which we got into the ravine, and the protection its banks afforded us, enabled us to get away without losing a man. Had the general's original plan been carried out, none of us would have come away to tell the story. I was summoned to the general's tent that evening. "That was a brilliant suggestion of yours, young man," he said. "This Indian fighting is a new business to me. I realize that if I had carried out my first order, not a man of us would ever have reached the command alive." I said, "General, do you remember the Battle of Tupido?" "I do," he said, with his chest expanding a little. "I was in command at that battle." The whipping of Forrest had been a particularly difficult and unusual feat, and General Smith never failed to show his pride in the achievement whenever the Battle of Tupido was mentioned. "Do you remember," I continued, "the young fellow you caught behind the tree, and sent for him afterward to ask him why he did so? Is it possible you are the man who found Forrest's command?" he asked in amazement. I had often wondered what became of you, he said, when I told him I was the same man. What have you been doing since the war? I told him I had come west, as a scout for General Sherman in 1865, and had been scouting ever since. He was highly delighted to see me again, and from that time forward, as long as he remained on the plains, I resumed my old position as his chief scout. After the Battle of Toledo, Smith's command was ordered to Memphis, and from there sent by boat up the Mississippi. We of the cavalry disembarked at Cape Girardeau, Smith remaining behind with the infantry, which came on later. General Sterling Price, of the Confederate Army, was at this time coming out of Arkansas into southern Missouri with a large army. His purpose was to invade Kansas. Federal troops were not then plentiful in the West. Smith's army from Tennessee, Blunt's troops from Kansas, what few regulars there were in Missouri, and some detachments of Kansas volunteers were all being moved forward to head off Price. Being still a member of the 9th Kansas Cavalry, I now found myself back in my old country, just ahead of Price's army, which had now reached the fertile northwestern Missouri. In carrying dispatches from General McNeil to General Blunt or General Pleasanton, I passed around and through Price's army many times. I always wore the disguise of a Confederate soldier, and always escaped detection. Price fought hard and successfully, gaining ground steadily, till at Westport, Missouri, and other battlefields near the Kansas line, the Federal troops checked his advance. At the Little Blue, a stream that runs through what is now Kansas City, he was finally turned south, and took up a course through southern Kansas. Near Mound City, a scouting party, of which I was a member, surprised a small detachment of Price's army. Our advantage was such that they surrendered, and while we were rounding them up I heard one of them say that we Yanks had captured a bigger prize than we suspected. When he was asked what this prize consisted of, the soldier said, "That big man over yonder is General Marmaduke of the Southern Army." I had heard much of Marmaduke, and greatly admired his dash and ability as a fighting man. Going over to him, I asked if there was anything I could do to make him comfortable. He said that I could. He hadn't had a bite to eat, and he wanted some food and wanted it right away. He was surrounding a good lunch I had in my saddlebag, while I was ransacking the saddlebag of a comrade for a bottle of whiskey, which I knew to be there. When we turned our prisoners over to the main command, I was put in charge of General Marmaduke, and accompanied him as his custodian to Fort Leavenworth. The general and I became fast friends, and our friendship lasted long after the war. Years after he had finished his term as governor of Missouri, he visited me in London, where I was giving my Wild West show. He was talking with me in my tent one day, when the Earl of Lonsdale and Lord Harrington rode up, dismounted, and came over to where we were sitting. I presented Marmaduke to them as the governor of one of America's greatest states and a famous Confederate general. Lonsdale, approaching and extending his hand, smiled and said, "Ah, Colonel Cody, another one of your Yankee friends, eh?" Marmaduke, who had risen, scowled. But he held out his hand. "Look here," he said, "I am much pleased to meet you, sir, but I want you first to understand distinctly that I am no Yank." When I left General Marmaduke at Leavenworth and returned to my command, Price was already in retreat. After driving him across the Arkansas River, I returned with my troop to Springfield, Missouri. From there I went, under General McNeil, to Fort Smith and other places on the Arkansas border, where we had several lively skirmishes, and one big and serious engagement, before the war was ended. The spring of 1865 found us again in Springfield, where we remained about 2 months, recuperating and replenishing our stock. I now got a furlough of 30 days, and went to St. Louis, where I invested part of $1,000 I had saved in fashionable clothes and in rooms at one of the best hotels. It was while there that I met a young lady of a southern family, to whom I paid a great deal of attention, and from whom I finally extracted a promise that if I would come back to St. Louis at the end of the war, she would marry me. On my return to Springfield, I found an expedition in process of fitting out for a scouting trip through New Mexico and into the Arkansas River country, to look after the Indians. With this party I took part in a number of Indian fights, and helped to save a number of immigrant trains from destruction. On our return to Fort Leavenworth, we found General Sanborn and a number of others of the former Union leaders, who had come to the border, to make peace with the Indians. The various tribes that roamed the plains had heard of the Great War, and, believing that it had so exhausted the white man, that he would fall an easy prey to Indian aggression, had begun to arm themselves and make ready for great conquests. They had obtained great stores of arms and ammunition. During the last 2 years of the war, they had been making repeated raids and inflicting vast damage on the settlers. At the close of the war, when the volunteers were discharged, I was left free to return to my old calling. The regular army was in course of consolidation. Men who had been generals were compelled to serve as colonels and majors. The Consolidated Army's chief business was in the west, where the Indians formed a real menace, and to the west came the famous fighting men, under whose command I was destined to spend many of the eventful years to come.